Chapter 26. "Those two there," Linda Ross said and pointed. Mark Murphy followed the line of her arm and spotted the couple immediately. While many of the passengers streaming off the golden sky were elderly, or at least middle-aged, she had spotted a man and woman in their 30s. Each held a hand of a little girl, about 8 years old, wearing a pink dress and Mary Jane's. "Candy from a baby," Mark said when he saw the woman hand her credit card-sized ship ID to her husband. He slipped it into his wallet and returned his wallet to his front pocket. Behind the army of disembarking passengers, eager to tour Hagia Sophia, the Blue Mosque, Topkapi Palace, and get fleeced at the bazaar, the Golden Sky looked eerily like her sister ship. Chilling memories rushed in on Mark every time he glanced up at her. He hadn't thought through his emotions very carefully when he'd volunteered for the mission and wasn't thrilled with the prospect of boarding her. "They're heading for the buses." Linda nodded to where the young family was veering toward the curb, where a dozen chartered buses idled. Passengers were showing attendants their day passes to board. "Do it now or follow them downtown?"
"No time like the present. Let's do it."
They waited for the three to get ahead of them before easing into the crowd. They moved effortlessly through the mostly slow-walking people until their target was just ahead of them and had no idea they were being tracked.
"Hurry!" Linda suddenly called out. "I think our bus is going to leave."
Mark quickened his pace and brushed against the man as he passed. The man immediately felt for his wallet. Keeping it in his front pocket and feeling for it when someone accidentally brushed into him showed the hallmark of a seasoned traveler. In most instances, this security practice would have been sufficient. But as they had planned, when Linda breezed by him, the passenger felt secure that the Americans rushing by weren't a threat, and he didn't check his pocket a second time. He hadn't felt Linda's small hand reach into his khakis and pull his wallet free. An amateur would have veered away from the mark as soon as the pocket had been picked, but Linda and Murph continued their ruse of being hurried passengers and strode for the buses. They loitered near one of them until the young family had showed their passes to an attendant on another bus and climbed aboard. Only then did Linda and Murph break from the crowd and head back to where they had parked their rental car. With Linda standing next to the open back door to shield the interior from curious passers-by, Mark worked on one of the laminated identification cards with a kit especially packed back on the Oregon. He used a scalpel to remove the transparent plastic and cut away the photograph. He then inserted an appropriate-sized picture of Linda from the stash he'd brought and ran the card through a battery-powered laminator. He spent a moment smoothing it out and trimming away excess plastic.
"There you go, Mrs. Susan Dudley," he said, showing Linda the still-warm card. "You seem to know what you're doing," Linda remarked. "I was 15 when I arrived at MIT, so you can best believe I know all about making fake IDs." There was a hint of something wan in his voice that Linda noticed. She said, "It must have been rough."
Mark paused from his work and looked up at her.
"You can imagine that place was loaded with Uber geeks, but I was a standout. Briefcase, tie, pocket protector, the whole enchilada. The school administration assured my parents they had counselors for accelerated students to make the transition easier. What a crock. I was on my own in the most competitive environment in the world. It only got worse when I went into the private sector. That's why I joined Juan and the corporation. Not for the money, huh?" Linda teased. "I'm not bragging or anything, but I took a serious pay cut when I joined up. It was worth it, you know? You guys treat me like an equal. When I was designing weapons systems, these macho generals would strut around looking at us like we were insects or something they had to scrape off the bottom of their shoe. Sure, they liked the toys we gave them, but they detested us for being able to deliver. It was like high school all over again, in the cafeteria, with the military guys sitting by themselves like a bunch of jocks and the rest of us hanging around the fringe, hoping to get noticed. Kind of pathetic, really. That doesn't happen on the Oregon. We're all on the same team. You and Link and Juan don't make Eric and me feel like outsiders, even though we push it a little with the whole nerd thing. And for the first time in my life, I don't feel I have to search for an empty table when I go into the mess hall. He seemed to look as though he'd said too much, so he threw her a grin and said, I hope you don't charge for geekotherapy. You can buy me a drink tonight on board. Mark looked startled, and then a knowing smirk raised his lip. We're not getting off the golden sky until we find something, are we? She pressed a hand to her breast in a shocked gesture. Are you actually accusing me of disobeying Eddie's direct order? Yep. Surprised? Nope. Still game? I'm fixing the second ID, aren't I? Good man. Mark fed the two cards into an electronic device attached to a laptop computer and recoded the embedded magnetic strips. 10 minutes later, he and Linda stood at the bottom of the Golden Sky's gangplank. Nearby, a forklift was loading pallets onto the ship through a large hatch while gulls wheeled and squawked above the vessel like warplanes in a dogfight. Is everything all right, Mr. Dudley? The assistant purser manning the gangplank asked when they said they wanted to return to their cabin. Just my knee, Mark said. I blew my ACL playing college football, and it flares up every once in a while. As you know, we have a doctor aboard who can look at it for you. The purser swiped the two cards through an electronic monitor. That's odd. Problem? No, well, yes. When I swiped your cards, my computer crashed. As part of any major cruise line's security, the electronic ID card brought up a file on the computer that had a picture of the bearer as well as information about his or her itinerary. Mark had recoded the stolen cards so that nothing would show on the screen. The purser would either have to trust that the two people standing before him were who they said they were, or delay them while someone fixed the computer. With customer service being so important, it was unlikely he would inconvenience passengers over a simple glitch. The purser ran his own employee identification through the scanner, and when his picture popped up on his screen, he handed the two IDs back to Murph. Your cards don't work anymore. When you get back to your cabin, ring the purser's office and they'll arrange replacements. Will do. Thanks. Mark took the IDs and shoved them in his pocket. Arm in arm, he and Linda climbed the ramp, with Murph playing up a limp. College football? She questioned when they were out of earshot. Mark patted his less-than-taut belly. So I've let myself go to seed. They entered the ship on the main atrium level. The ceiling lofted 4 stories and was crowned with a stained glass dome. A pair of glass elevators gave access to the upper levels, and each deck was fringed by safety glass panels capped by gleaming brass rails. A rose marble wall with water sheeting down its face and collecting in a discreet fountain was opposite the elevators. From their vantage, they could see signs for small luxury stores 1 deck up and a neon fixture lighting the way to the casino. The overall effect was opulence bordering on tacky. They had discussed their plan while still on the Oregon, and both had studied the layout of the ship from the cruise line's website, so there was no need to talk now. They went straight for the public restrooms behind the fountain. Linda handed Mark a bundle of clothing from her utilitarian shoulder bag. Moments later, they reemerged dressed in workers' overalls with the cruise line's logo stitched in gold thread over their hearts, thanks to Kevin Nixon's magic shop. Linda had scrubbed off most of her makeup, and Mark had tamed his unruly hair with a cruise line baseball cap. The maintenance crew uniforms gave them the virtual run of the ship. Where do we meet if we get separated? Linda asked as they started walking. The craps table? Don't be cute. Library. Library, she parroted. All right, let's go play Nancy Drew. Hardy Boys. It's my operation, so it's my call. You can be my sidekick, George Fane. To Linda's surprise, Mark asked, Not Ned Nickerson? It was the name of Nancy's boyfriend. Not in your wildest dreams. And someday we need to talk about your adolescent reading habits. Or maybe we shouldn't. The easiest way to leave the ship's public accommodations was through the galley, so they climbed a flight of nearby stairs and found the main dining room. Large enough to seat 300 people, the room was empty except for a house-cleaning crew vacuuming the carpet. They weaved purposefully through the tables toward the back and entered the kitchen. A chef looked up from his cooking but said nothing as the duo strode in. Linda glanced away. Unlike the dining room, the galley was loaded with staff preparing the next meal. Aromatic steam rose from bubbling pots as assistant chefs cleaned, chopped, and sliced away in a 24-hour-a-day operation. There was a door at the rear of the kitchen that led to a brightly lit hallway. They found a staircase and descended, passing a bevy of waitresses heading up for their shift. They encountered several more people, but no one paid them the slightest attention. As janitors, they were practically invisible. Mark spotted a folding ladder leaning against a bulkhead and grabbed it to further their disguise. With the golden sky tied to the dock and most passengers ashore, she was drawing minimal power, and as a result, her engineering spaces were deserted. Linda and Mark spent the next several hours crawling over every pipe, conduit, and duct, looking for anything out of the ordinary. Unlike Juan's time on the sky's ill-fated sister ship, their search was unhurried and methodical, but in the end, the results were essentially the same. "Nothing," Mark said, the frustration in his voice coming from his anger at himself for not figuring it out. "Not one damn thing that shouldn't be here. Nothing attached to the ventilation system or the water supply. Those are the most efficient ways of spreading a virus, sure." Linda used a ball of cotton waste to wipe grease off her hands. "What else is there?" "Short of walking around and spritzing every surface on the ship with an atomizer, I can't think of anything. If we've had this much time down here by ourselves, the responsivists probably did too." He pointed overhead, where ducts as big as barrels were anchored to the ceiling. "In 2 hours, I could take apart a section of that and set up my dispersal system inside." Linda shook her head. "The risk of being caught is too great. It has to be something much simpler and quicker." "I know, I know, I know." Mark rubbed his temples, where the beginnings of a headache was pressing in on his brain. "I remember Juan on the Golden Dawn saying he wanted to look at the main intakes for the air conditioning system. That might be something to check." "Where would they be?" "Topside. On the front of the funnel, most likely." "That's pretty exposed." "We should wait until tonight." "Then let's head back to the public areas and change." Meandering their way out of the labyrinthine engine room, they finally came out into a corridor filled with people. Guest service workers in various uniforms were gearing up for the passengers' return, and engineers were making their way to the engine room in preparation for leaving Istanbul. A chance glimpse through a doorway near the laundry suddenly brought Linda up short. A man in his 30s, wearing a uniform much like the one she had on, was standing just outside the laundry. It wasn't the man or even his casual stance that caught her eye. It was the way he looked away when their eyes met. She recognized the same furtive glance she herself had given the first chef she'd seen in the galley. It was the look of someone who was somewhere he wasn't supposed to be. He turned away slightly, but then peeked back over his shoulder. As soon as he saw Linda still studying him, he took off running in the opposite direction. "Hey!" Linda shouted. "Stop!" She started after him, with Mark a pace or two behind. "No," Linda said sharply. "Check if there are any more of them down there." Mark turned and ran back, leaving Linda in sole pursuit. The runner had a 20-foot head start and 6-inch longer legs. The advantages seemed to do him no good because Linda's determination to catch him was simply greater than his body's ability to get away. She quickly cut down his lead, running around corners without a check in her pace, springing as lightly as a gazelle, but with the ferocity of a hunting cheetah. He gained some distance when they climbed a flight of stairs. He was able to take the steps 3 at a time to Linda's 2. They raced past startled workers. Linda wished more than anything that she could call out for help, but that would leave her explaining her illegal presence on the ship. The man flashed through a doorway, and when Linda reached it a moment later, she scraped her arm, cutting it so close. She never saw the fist. He cold-cocked her right on the point of her chin. Even though the man was no trained fighter, the blow was enough to snap Linda's head back and slam her into a wall. He stood over her for a second before running, leaving Linda struggling to clear her mind. Before she was certain she was up to it, she was on her feet and after him again, swaying dizzily with each pace. "Hit a girl, will you?" she grunted. They broke out onto Broadway, the long central corridor that ran nearly the length of the ship and was used by the crew to get from their cabins to their duty areas. Some artistic crew member had even made up theater-style marquees like those along the famed New York Street the hallway took its name from. "Coming through! Emergency!" Linda could hear the man calling out as they dashed through the congestion of workers, either heading to their posts or hanging out and socializing. He moved through the crowd like a snake, weaving around people and gaining precious ground, while Linda felt like her head was going to explode from the growing ball of cotton that had been her brain. He twisted through another door and started climbing more stairs. Linda pounded open the door 5 seconds after him. She used the handrail to launch herself up each flight of steps, throwing her body around the corners because she knew that they were fast approaching the passengers' accommodations area. If the guy was smart, and if he knew the ship, they could emerge close to his cabin. If Linda didn't see which one, she'd never be able to find him again. He burst through the door at the top of the stairs, bowling over an elderly woman and knocking her husband out of his wheelchair. He lost precious seconds disentangling himself from the couple. Linda flew through the door before the automatic mechanism could close it. She gave a savage grin. They'd emerged on the upper level near the atrium. The man looked back to see Linda only a few paces behind. He quickened his stride, running for the elegant stairs that curled around the twin glass elevators. There was very little for passengers on the top level of the atrium. The shops were one level down, and the lower levels would certainly be more crowded. Linda had seen guards outside the ship's exclusive jewelry store earlier, and she couldn't gamble being stopped by security. They were almost to the stairs when she leapt, her arms outstretched. Her fingers caught on the cuffs of the man's jumpsuit, which was enough to trip him up. They had been running flat out, so his momentum propelled him head first into the glass panel railing. The panel was designed for just such an impact, but a weld that held a bracket in place popped, and the entire panel broke free. It tumbled 4 stories before hitting the floor in a tremendous explosion of flying fragments. Startled screams filled the atrium. Linda had lost her grip as soon as she made contact and sprawled on her chest, sliding on the slick floor after the responsivist. He managed to grab onto a brass banister as he tumbled over the edge, and for a moment, he looked up at her as she tried to reach his hand. She imagined the look in his eye was that of a suicide bomber the instant before detonation. Resignation, fear, pride, and most of all, defiant rage. He let go before she could clutch his wrist and didn't turn from her gaze as he plummeted. He dropped the 40 feet, flattening himself out so he hit the tile floor on his back, his head turning to the side at the last second. The sound was a wet slap, and slivers of shattered bone burst through his clothes in a dozen bloody patches. Even from this height, Linda could tell his skull had lost half its width. Giving herself no time to digest the horror, she sprang to her feet. The elderly couple was still struggling to get the old man back in his wheelchair and hadn't seen a thing. She moved behind an enormous potted palm and stripped off the overalls and stuffed them into her bag. There was nothing she could do about the damp stains under the arms of her blouse. The library was well forward near the ship's movie theater, but Linda turned aft. There was a bar that overlooked the pool near the stern, and she knew that if she didn't get a brandy in the next 2 minutes, her breakfast was going to make an encore appearance. She was still sitting there an hour later when a Turkish ambulance pulled away from the ship, its lights off and sirens silent. Moments later, the ship's horn gave a trumpeting blast.
The golden sky was finally leaving port.